The music landscape has changed a lot since the turn of the 21st century. Not just styles, but how we consume music. Nothing illustrates that better than the rise of the indie music scene. In his new book, Such Great Heights, Stereogum managing editor Chris DeVille looks at how changes to TV, the internet, and the record industry fueled the indie music bubble. He tells WDET's Russ McNamara that television and technology played significant roles.
Even one of the very first articles I ever wrote for the site was about the OC, the TV show, the OC, and indie rock gentrification, sort of like the same way you think about like all the artists moving into like a cheap rundown neighborhood, and then they make it cool, and then all of the money comes in, and then they get kind of priced out, and it becomes like, you know, kind of a neighborhood as a mall. I was seeing the same kind of thing happening in independent rock music, and I saw even like, but there that makes it sound negative. There's some positive aspects of it too. I mean, like, we're expanding the scope of like who's coming in contact with it, who even gets to be participating in indie rock. It used to be such like white guys with guitars, and mm-hmm. like different types of music gained an influence in the sound of the music, and it became a lot more woman friendly. And I think the racial dimension of it is still, you know, it's still very white. And I think that people who are sort of the gatekeepers of indie rock really made an effort to diversify points of view. And it's like kind of a complex situation that I'm tracking. It's like this music breaking through and impacting the mainstream, but then also being influenced by the mainstream at the same time. And there's many different sort of through lines that are being traced here. One of them is technology too. I know that I'm kind of like, you gave me one question and I'm off to the races here, but it's a subject that I think is really complex and really fascinating. And it involves a lot of my favorite music ever. That this is stuff that has been kind of chronicled and debated online for years, you know, in blog posts and social media posts, and now I guess like Substack posts. And a lot of the documentation of it is starting to disappear because like websites just go offline, or mm-hmm. people delete their social media accounts, or like, you know, it's buried in some message board thread from 20 years ago. And so I wanted to create like a little bit more permanent record of some of these things that happened, some of the ways that these bands broke through, some of the conversations that were being had around this music. And it ends up being like a history of my listening as an adult.
Right. No, because there is a very good reason why my Blogspot blog no longer exists. I do have to say, I'm glad you brought up the OC. Because I was fresh out of college then, and so working at a college radio station, I was exposed to it, like a ton of great music. As the music started to change, you know, we're post-Y2K, post-9/11. The first time I ever heard Spoon was on an episode of The OC. That's the way we get by, to the way we get by. All that way we get by, to the way we get by. I do have to say that I did have, I think it's like Mix Volume 1.
Yeah.
I had Mix Volume 1 of the OC, and introduced me to a lot of new stuff. Even though it's a little bit of gentrification, as you put it, it did stick with you. And like, how much of that was just like the ability to hop on LimeWire or something like that and download those tracks and make it easily accessible to people? And the internet was new, and everything had seemingly changed in a very short period of time because of technological advances.
Oh, yeah. It's like, I was surprised as I was writing the book how much it became like a shadow history of like the internet, like the evolution of the internet over the last couple decades. And, you know, the OC thing, it's like they're putting these bands in front of a much bigger audience. Like Death Cab for Cutie is like a fairly obscure band at the time, and then this character on this popular teen show is like making his whole personality that he loves Death Cab for Cutie. I want to live where soul meets body. It's like giant platform, but then they lose cool points with some people as, you know, sort of a more normie audience discovers this band. But it's there's no doubt that it was a huge like funnel bringing a bunch of bands to a much broader audience. Even Britt Daniel from Spoon, he said that on a podcast. I quoted him in the book talking about how like he gets more people coming up to him and saying, "I heard you on the OC," than anything else. And but yeah, as far as the technological dimension of it, it's like LimeWire, Napster, Audio Galaxy, whatever platform you were using to pirate music, that I think contributed to the accessibility of stuff. Stuff could blow up, even if it didn't fit into a particular radio format or it wasn't getting, you know, past the MTV gatekeepers. It didn't have to fit into any existing niche or existing format to blow up. It could just, you know, catch fire and go viral, as we say now, on these file sharing servers. I mean, the same thing was still true when iTunes came in and kind of formalized and commercialized the process. You could still have a song that would just, people would download it like crazy on iTunes. And the same thing was true with MySpace too. Like there's a chapter in the book that talks about iTunes and MySpace and sort of the impact that that had on indie music. And there was an availability thing where it's like, yeah, all of a sudden, if a song catches on, you can just download it and it's there. Or like with MySpace, you're networking with other bands. You click on one of your favorite bands, and then in their top eight, the accessibility is suddenly there, where you don't have to be going to your local record store, going to see the bands that are touring through your like 200 capacity club in your town. In the 90s, being into this like underground rock music took a lot of like personal investment in like a physical space. Because of the internet, the music came to you, and the barrier to entry. Another thing that the internet did, it exposed people to all different music. It became a lot easier to dabble in a lot of different genres. Right. And it became a lot less kind of like just reined in, like, oh, I'm a hip hop head, or I'm a metal head, or, you know, whatever genre you're going to define yourself by. It became cool to be eclectic. I mean, it was always cool. Like if you listen to like James Murphy, Losing My Edge, right. LCD Sound System.
I'm losing my edge. The kids are coming up from behind.
He's like being eclectic in that. And like for like a hipster, I guess there was always a cool eclecticism dimension, but that became like with the iPod era, it was like everybody was mixing and matching all these different genres. And I think that had an impact on the evolution of the sound of indie rock too.
Yeah, it's funny because I was going to bring up Losing My Edge because, you know, when people say they're losing cool points for being on a show like The OC, I mean, it seems like they're talking specifically to the character that James Murphy was playing in Losing My Edge. Because, you know, like, well, yeah, I knew this band before when. I knew this band right. before when. And so which bands do you think kind of benefited most? Because when I think of this era, I think of like the constant stream of this is going to be the next biggest band ever. Because you get like huge hype with a band like Arcade Fire and Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah, those kind of bands.
Yeah. So, I mean, Arcade Fire was definitely the biggest. The other dimension that we haven't brought up yet that I talk a lot about in the book is Pitchfork.
Yeah.
And just like the power that Pitchfork had to like make or break someone's career, that they had developed such a loyal audience that was just ready to, if they gave something to 10.0, people were just going to jump on it and worship it. And if they kind of talked smack about a particular band, completely panned a band, then there were instances where that basically ended someone's commercial right. prospects. And so like Arcade Fire were like the perfect storm of, they kind of proved that this pipeline of blog hype funneled upward into a rave Pitchfork review could launch a band to like an actual career. And so, you know, they went on to, they skipped past playing Pitchfork Music Festival and went straight to playing Lollapalooza. And it's like they had David Bowie, you know, on stage with them, and Bono, and then fast forward a few years and they win the Grammy for Album of the Year. Mm-hmm. And like they're playing like White House events with Obama, and like they were like, you know, absolutely the number one biggest beneficiary of this boom, or like kind of the, I think, the definitive band of that era when it comes to like indie rock exploding into the mainstream. But so besides them, I mean, the thing was, after Arcade Fire, you get a bunch of, there's all the race to find the new Arcade Fire, the next Arcade Fire. And because it's blogs, you know, you no longer are chained to the like print media schedule of newspapers coming out once a day, magazines coming out once a month. It's right. Like the blogs are posting new music every single day. And so it's like every week you're trying to find like the next Arcade Fire. And so not many bands are going to be ready to live up to that standard. And so you get Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah is a great example of like they came along the year after Arcade Fire. And their album was really good, but like they were not like as ready for prime time. Like they weren't a professional live band in the same way that some of these indie bands. And that's the thing, like there was a professionalization happening too. So like, yeah, you know, Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah, they get all this buzz. They've got a self-released album. It's not on a label, and Pitchfork is, you know, anointing it as like, wow, this is the way it's supposed to be. There's no publicist. We're just discovering this great band. And it turns out they're just like a pretty good band. They come out with a second album that's like clearly, you know, not designed to take them to the stratosphere. And so there are some cautionary tales, like of, you know, sort of bloggers and critics sort of desperately searching for the next big thing. And it doesn't always just come along naturally. Sometimes they try to force it. That was definitely a phenomenon that was taking place during this era. And I mean, it still is taking place.
So to kind of put a bow on this, where are we heading? I mean, is indie dead at this point, or is everything indie now when YouTube has taken over? A song can go viral on TikTok and then rocket to the top of the charts now. Like, does it really matter? And are labels in trouble because of this?
Yeah. So indie, it's interesting. So like indie, you know, it started out just meaning like this is independently released. It's on an independent label. It's not part of the major label system. But then over time, indie became like more of a genre, and then the genre itself started to change. And so, but I think what we saw happen in the 2010s is sort of like the indie goes pop thing. It was like a bubble, and it really did pop. We still have these sort of like boutique pop stars like Claro. I think we could do it if we tried, if only to say you're mine. Sophia, know that you and I shouldn't feel like a crime. I think, you know, they started to incorporate the rock side back into it a little bit more, sort of blurring between pop and rock in an interesting way. You know, we had artists that came out of the indie world became pop stars of a sort because of stuff like TikTok. Like Mitski is a good example of that, where like, right, you know, she's coming from the indie rock infrastructure, and she is making music that jumps across genres a little bit. But she blew up on TikTok, and you know, she has the same kind of fan community around her that like a pop star would have. Like she has stans, like you know, sort of a community of super fans. But yeah, it's like we got to the point where like Taylor Swift worked with Aaron Dessner from The National on Folklore, and people called that her indie album. And it's like it was the biggest album of the year. It was on a major label. It won Album of the Year at the Grammys. There was like nothing indie about it. Like, you know, it was independent from what? It wasn't like, it was very much part of the machine, but like its sound was like sort of indie-ish. And so, yeah, that's kind of was my end point that I chose for the book, was that, like, you know, does the word indie even mean anything anymore? And maybe, you know, do we need new language? Do we need some, like, new subgenres? But I do think that as all that was happening, you know, every generation you get a new wave coming up. And so we have some, like, we have, like, kind of a new generation of, like, Gen Z indie rock stars that have blown up now. You know, you got Wednesday and MJ Linderman, you got Geese. There are these bands that are from England. You got all these bands from what they call the windmill scene in London that, like, have very dedicated audiences, sort of like a little bit more abrasive, artsy bands. And I think that that's been kind of the wave lately, is that there's a hunger for bands that have a little bit more of an edge to them, that are a little bit less smooth, a little bit willing to be weird or noisy, or, like, I mean, that's what you see with a lot of the biggest indie bands today, are ones that have gone against that sort of, like, Spotify friendly, like, the passive listening type experience. Because that's something we haven't even discussed, is the role of streaming in all this. It really, in the 2010s, incentivized, like, a more passive listening experience, music that, you know, the chill beats to study to type thing.
Right.
I think what we see now is sort of a reaction against that smoothness. And there is at least a segment of the listening audience that wants something that's going to kind of, like, jolt them out of their stupor, like, not music that's just to put on while you study, but music that you're going to engage with, that you're going to, like, have an emotional experience with, music that is not for everyone, like, music that isn't trying to be necessarily, like, everyone's cup of tea. It's like Carly from Wednesday, you know, sometimes she sings, sometimes she screams.
But everybody gets along just fine, 'cause the champagne tastes like elderberry wine.
And Cameron Winter from Geese, he's made, you know, his mm-hmm. voice is definitely an acquired taste.
Look out, baby!
It's like, I love it. I tried to play it for my wife and kids and they revolted in the car. It's like, I think that, you know, there's some people who would argue that indie music should be like that. It should, you know, sort of, like, grate against some people. It shouldn't be for everyone. But that's one of the big questions in the book, is, like, you know, how do you keep it as a closed club? But, like, isn't that just going against kind of, like, the natural forces of, like, music? Music wants to evolve. It wants to find new audiences. And so the whole idea of, like, gatekeeping and having the right audience versus the wrong audience, like, that's something that factors into the book too.
That's Chris DeVille, the managing editor of the indie music site Stereo Gum. He spoke with WDET's Russ McNamara about his book, Such Great Heights, the complete cultural history of the indie rock explosion.